Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. My pleasure to talk to Richard Kerr about his book, Fighting for Our Health. He has been battling with the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and most recently the Obama administration, to get some type of rational healthcare system in this country. The fact you should have to battle your own friends is a bit indicative of the weird attitudes in the United States to healthcare and why it is that so many people are opposed to the rational systems that the rest of the world has. How do you cope with this, and why do you think it is, Richard?
Well, you know, the history of trying to get a government right to healthcare in this country goes back 100 years now, really since the first efforts were made in the 19-teens. And what we've seen in every effort throughout history, that there's been two big barriers that have been closely related to getting a basic right for healthcare in this country. One is ideology, and that opponents of healthcare have really insisted that it was foreign to the United States, that it was a communist idea, that it was a totalitarian idea, a socialist idea. Those were the way it was framed through most of the 20th century. And then in the last fights and in the fight in this century, it was a big government idea. So they've used that argument and to scare people that this was un-American. And the people who have really been behind that argument a lot of times have done it for another big reason, which is they thought they would lose money in a healthcare system in which the government had a role in making healthcare affordable and then therefore controlling how much we paid for healthcare. So you had
started in there, because that's a great American tradition which is still practiced, is you have a bunch of people of absolutely cynical motives, like the American Medical Association for many years, and now the insurance companies in particular, who are going to make loads and loads of money. And they always manage to bamboozle other people by invoking high principles. Remember the Jack Abramoff and his lobbyists, that they said the key was to getting hold of the wackos and mobilize them behind whatever you wanted them to do. And you do that by getting high-sounding phrases like communism, socialized medicine, government control, I presume.
Right. Well, that motivates the wackos, and it also then raises questions just in average people's minds. And unless they hear another story coming back at them, they'll be stuck there. But what's happened, and one of the big reasons that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, passed is one of the first times that there was well-organized forces for change pushing back against the arguments for those opposed to change. Because we've seen, for instance, when Harry Truman tried to get healthcare done, the AMA organized this huge, it was the first really big, you know, we call AstroTurf, grassroots organized by an industry, with these political consultants were hired to organize all around the country, and doctors' offices were involved. And every time we went to doctor's office, there were posters and brochures, and there were all sorts of ways of getting people ginned up against the idea that somehow having health insurance for everyone in the country would be un-American and would be an idea that they made up a quote from Lenin. So the difference was that this time around, we actually had a lot of money to organize support and to push back and tell our own story. And we tell our story that, you know, first of all, healthcare, everyone should have quality, affordable healthcare. And second of all, that right now you're at the mercy of the private health insurance industry, and remind people that under the current system, if you're sick, you can't get healthcare. If you lose your job, you can't get healthcare. Oftentimes, if you're working, you can't get healthcare. And that the insurance industry is denying you care. And if people hear that story, the motto of our campaign was, if the insurance companies win, you lose.
Mm. I mean, one of the issues here, of course, I gather from reading your book and from talking to other people involved in the campaign, is that there are two things about Americans. One is, if they have insurance, They sort of don't really see it's their problem, even though they might, unless you persuade them that they could lose it at any moment, or their children could lose it at any moment. But, you know, this is sort of, trying to get people worried about the future is always a little difficult, unless you're in hard times. And the second part is this sort of total gullibility, isn't it? That that they really think this is the best healthcare system in the world.
In some ways, the things you just talked about are related. Healthcare is something which is incredibly personal and incredibly important to people. And so it's very easy to scare people about change. Even if they don't like what they have now, if they have anything at all, they worry about that change will make it worse. And because they care about it so deeply, it's easier to scare people. So that's one of the reasons that we learned, and President Obama learned, to reassure people by first saying, if you like your health care, you can keep it. And that helped people be more relaxed about it, deal with the fear of change. But then reminding people that they don't really have health care security. And, you know, when so many people are losing their jobs, and when so many jobs don't have health coverage, then more and it's easy to say to people, but, you know, what happens if you lose your job? What happens if your employer drops your health coverage? What happens if you're sick and your insurance company won't give you the care you need? And the best way we reminded people of that was not by making the arguments directly, although but was connecting with stories. And so much of what we did is the stories of people who had good insurance, but then lost it because they lost their jobs. And then, you know, people who died because of that, family members telling those stories, or people who had been denied care because of a pre-existing condition as simple as went to the doctor for a high cholesterol test and not be able to get insurance anymore. So having people tell those stories reminded people of what they needed, what was at stake. And so reassuring people they could like what they could keep if they liked it, but then saying, but you know, there's a lot here that we need to change that could affect you. That was the combination that convinced people to support reform.
Looking at all the other Republican campaigns of the last decade or so, to what extent was there a dog whistle here? The feeling that the people who were uninsured were feckless minorities, and I don't want to pay for their health care. Was that an undertone message going out?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the right is always trying to say it's those people. And what's true is that a lot of people assumed that the whole point of healthcare was to get insurance for people who didn't have it. And so it was easy to play into being those people, the other people who don't work hard, people who aren't undeserving, which is, again, why the stories we told were so much of people who actually were working people and didn't have health insurance, or lost their health insurance, or had been screwed by their health insurance companies. So we told a story a lot, and it was a typical story. It was a small businessman named Dan Sherry, who had paid his insurance payment every month for years, and he had a huge order at work. And because of that little small business in a big order, he missed one insurance payment. And when he went to make the following month, when he went to make that payment up, the insurance company wouldn't take his money and had him do a medical test. And because he had high cholesterol, they wouldn't insure him. And he was told by his lawyer, if you want to protect your wife and your kids, you have to, the only way to, from financial catastrophe if you get sick, is to get divorced. So those are the kind of stories we told. And another great story is there's if you look at the pictures of the president signing the law, standing next to him is this very adorable kid named Marcellus Owens from Seattle. And his mother died because she didn't have health insurance. And the story he tells is that his mother was working at Jack in the Box as a manager when she had health insurance because she was a manager there. But she got very, very sick and started missing work, and she was fired. And because she was fired, she couldn't get the health, she lost her health insurance. She couldn't get the health insurance she needed, and she died. So those kind of stories help people understand what was at stake.
I mean, it's the fact that a lot of people accept this. I had a friend who was a manager of a restaurant like that, And she was actually in hospital with huge intestinal surgery. She was on a drip and on all sorts of machinery. And her employer came in and said that because she was off sick, she wasn't going to pay her health insurance premiums anymore. So she had to keep them up.
Right. I mean,
while she was in hospital. I mean, this makes sort of Mr. Scrooge seem like a beaming philanthropist even before he saw the ghost, doesn't it?
Yes. No, that's outrageous. But, you know, to have her employer come into the hospital and tell her is the unusual part. Most of the time you just get dropped unceremoniously without any kind of courtesy to even tell you that Scrooge doesn't show up in person. Scrooge just is a letter.
Well, what struck me was my friend when I said, look, I said, you know, anywhere in Europe, you would not only have free health care, but you'd be on full sick pay for 6 months. And she said, but no one would ever work then. And I thought, this is a very American attitude. That
I know one ever worked then, yes. Well, that's, as you know, that's not true. You know, the thing that Americans don't realize is we work many, many more hours than people in other countries. And we do it with no security. In other countries, if you have a child, you get paid time off and you get flexibility. And oftentimes for several years, it's a flex time so you can be sure you have enough time to take care of the child with pay, with most of your pay. You get paid sick days automatically. Here, a great many low-wage workers don't have paid sick days. And health insurance is something which, you know, many jobs don't come with. And so people in this country, they have no idea that they think that work is a privilege and not a right. But what's true is that a good job that pays well, that has good benefits and security, is something that should be guaranteed to everyone. And people work in Europe, but they're not slaves to their work because if they miss a day because their child's sick and take home, that doesn't threaten their ability to keep their job. That's totally crazy as well as inhumane. It also undermines the economy. You can't have a strong economy that moves forward if people are so insecure all the time that they might lose their work because they don't continue to have the incomes they need to buy goods in their communities and to keep the economy going.
Well, actually, if you look, the most productive workers in the world and one of the countries which still depends upon exports is Germany, where the workers are on, 38 hours a week, 3 months, 6 weeks a year paid leave, and pretty much unlimited sick pay. So there's no correlation between productivity and the whip of poverty.
No, and what's true in those countries is that because they have more people working and they get paid decently, that's a key to keeping the economy moving forward. You know, it's really working families in the middle class that are the engines of the economy. We have a country, one of the big reasons that, you know, our economy's slowed down so much is we're paying so many people so much less, while a few people are getting so much more.
Yeah, and, which they don't go and spend in the local McDonald's.
Yeah, that's right. And they don't spend in the McDonald's, and they don't spend a lot of it. And if they do, it may be someplace besides the local communities. It may be overseas. And when we have average people have decent incomes, they're going to spend it in their communities, and that moves the economy forward.
There, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Richard Kirsch, who's, I believe it's your first book, isn't it, Richard, Fighting for Our Health, details the struggles to, I mean, it's not just a sort of anti-rant here, you're describing the tactics that you use to overcome these sort of mental obstacles in the American political system and the voters, but I mean, were you surprised that you ran into so much resistance to, a single-payer system with the Obama administration?
No. I mean, and I don't fault the Obama administration for that at all. For your listeners who aren't familiar with the terms, so single-payer basically is a term that is like national health insurance. We have a single-payer system in Medicare for the country, and it's what they have in Canada, where there's one national insurance company organized by the government. All the doctors are in private practice, hospitals are independent entities, nonprofit or for-profit. But no, because it would not work in this country to tell everybody that you have to give up your insurance for government insurance. People would just not begin to accept that. And that's what single payer is. And, you know, if you can say it's Medicare for all, and that sounds better. But the fact is that lots of people who have health insurance at work are not going to want to give that up for a government-run health insurance policy, and that's what single payer is. So single payer is not just there's good reasons that the Obama administration didn't support it, and frankly, we understand it's good policy. Our campaign wasn't based on that. Our campaign was based on the idea that we wanted to be sure everybody had good insurance. We wanted to do two things. Well, three things. First, we wanted to make it affordable to people, so you pay based on what your income was. Second, we wanted to regulate the private insurance industry so it couldn't drop you because you had a pre-existing condition or charge you more because you were sick or stop paying your bills, your insurance bills, because you spent too much because you had a serious condition. And third of all, we wanted to give people an option of a public health insurance plan so that as well as you weren't at the mercy of the private health insurance companies. So it's not the same thing as everybody's going to be in a government health insurance plan, but we wanted a public health insurance option so that people would have a choice of something besides private health insurance.
Medicare for all seemed like a good idea if that was an option. In Taiwan, for example, where I went, this rabidly capitalist society introduced a single-payer system about 10 years ago. And it's the cheapest in the world. I think it's cost less than 5% of GDP, because that's the other part we're forgetting in these times of macroeconomic despair over the budget and the deficits and lack of productivity, that the U.S. has the highest proportion of its GDP on healthcare in the world to produce results which are pretty mediocre. I think didn't a recent survey put the U.S. as 17th in the for longevity.
Yes, our healthcare system, if you look at what the economists would say, efficiency, which is what you get for your money, basically, it's a fancy term for that, we're by far the least efficient healthcare system in the world. We spend by far the most and we get the least. We have, we don't live as long, our babies die sooner, we have all sorts of incidences of serious preventable conditions that we shouldn't have. And one reason is because we have this for-profit healthcare system, and because we treat healthcare as a market private good, and when it's not, it's a public good. And you know, think about what markets work. You go shopping for a car, and you enter the market on your own. It's why it's a market. You decide what kind of car you like that you can afford. You want to spend more for the leather, et cetera. If you're an informed consumer, maybe you look at Consumer Reports. That's what makes a market. But healthcare, who goes into the healthcare system voluntarily for this stuff? It costs a lot. You know, do you say, I'd rather have cancer or heart condition? Which do I want to buy today? And then if you're diagnosed with cancer, do you say, well, let's see, what's cheaper, radiation or chemo? You know, the things that drive healthcare, the people that are – is not voluntary. It's not a market. And the demand is not generated by the consumer. It's generated by – the suppliers. There's no because it's the doctor who's going to tell you where you have to go for tests, what tests you need, what treatment you want. And so every other country treats healthcare not as a private good, as a public good, which means everybody gets in the system and it's affordable. And the government basically says to providers how much we're going to pay you. And so they don't allow providers, doctors, hospitals, drug companies to totally rip off the system, and that's what we see here so often.
In fact, only this morning, just before calling you, I had a phone call from a marketing call from someone asking if I was a Medicare patient with diabetes and or heart problems, and that they wanted to offer me all sorts of services, presumably to be billed to Medicare.
Right.
How do you stop that type of ripoff? One of the things they did in Taiwan was to have an insurance card with a chip which actually has all of your medical information. So if you once that goes in there, if you've been getting multiple prescriptions, a duplicate prescription, say, or unnecessary treatments, the computers, the Taiwanese National Health Service computers immediately flag it and come down like a ton of bricks on the sort of profiteering suppliers.
Well, what you want to do that, I mean, for other reasons too, just for improving your health, you want to be able to see that you're not taking drugs that have you know, you can't take together. The doctor doesn't know that. Oftentimes you'll go to the doctor and he'll give you a test or she'll give you a test, and then you go to the hospital. They want to give you the same test as having access to the records, the test you just had. They make more money on it. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we are moving into this in this country is a greater use of electronic medical records. That's something that we are slowly moving towards, and that is one of the things that's promoted in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. But the fact is we still have these terrible incentives. I mean, the biggest examples are the drug companies. You know, we pay much more for pharmaceuticals here than any other country in the world, the same drugs. You know, I don't know if you know, Ian, who gets the lowest prices for drugs in this country? It's the Veterans Administration, because the VA actually uses its bargaining power not just to pay whatever the drug companies want, but to say we've got, you know, we're buying on behalf of millions of veterans, we're only going to pay you this much. And the drug companies are such a powerful lobby with their campaign contributions and their thousands of lobbyists that they've stopped that from happening in Congress. They stopped the Affordable Care Act. They've stopped it in Medicare.
Yeah, the lobbyists actually worked hard to prevent any type of bargaining power,
right,
didn't they?
Right. They stopped when Medicare 10 years ago introduced starting to pay for prescription drugs. You had to buy it through private insurance, and the drug company, and they weren't allowed to control how much were paid for drugs. So you weren't allowed to have Medicare bargain with the prescription drug companies for the lowest prices, or really set the prices like they do every place else, like the VA does. That was specifically prohibited in the legislation.
And then recently we have Obama-appointed attorneys, district attorneys, prosecuting people for importing drugs from Canada.
Yeah, and this is crazy, and because they're importing the same drugs that are federally FDA approved, that are oftentimes made here, shipped to Canada, and sold at half the price in Canada because the Canadian government doesn't allow the drug companies to rip the country off. And so this is the kind of challenges we have here. But I want to say that what people should understand is that the Affordable Care Act does take a major step towards changing this. It does, for the first time, say that the government has responsibility to make health care affordable. It will lead to tens of millions of people getting affordable coverage. It stops insurance companies from denying care because of pre-existing conditions. It says insurance companies can't stop paying if you're sick because you've used up too much insurance. And most importantly, because it starts having this major government role, it starts making healthcare much more of a public good. It's not a government take over the healthcare system. It's government starting to say that we're going to be sure that healthcare is affordable to everyone. And as part of that, we're going to start putting the kind of common sense rules that don't allow insurance companies to deny care to people who need it or charge you more because you're sick. And starts to say we're going to look at how much we pay for care and pay for care we need, not care that's a waste.
Well, one of the points here, of course, is the, as I remember, didn't the healthcare lobby, the insurance lobby in particular, show astounding duplicity, and the administration show a considerable degree of naivety, because the affordable healthcare bill, Obamacare, actually gave them all sorts of concessions in return for their support, and then they privately went off and lobbied against it all, having got what they wanted. They hedged, shall we say. just in case it got through, they managed to blunt its impact on them, and then they managed to lobby against it and hope to kill it as well.
Well, it's true. They supported the legislation, or the move towards the legislation. And then in the fall of 2009, they started funneling tens of million dollars to the Chamber of Commerce to kill the legislation. But it was too late because the momentum had been built up. And at that point, we had a strong enough head of steam behind us. So the campaign that we built at Healthcare for America Now and other efforts to pass the legislation. The insurance industry continues to have mixed feelings about the legislation. They like the fact they're going to get a lot of new customers. They don't like the fact that it comes with some requirements that they have to provide coverage to everybody, regardless of pre-existing conditions, or they can't charge you more because you're sick. So they continue to try to weaken the regulations, but they're also glad to get the new customers.
You know, a lot of people on the sort of left and more liberal end of the spectrum have a big down on Obama, but there's others who say that actually, in a very pragmatic way, he achieved a lot with this. I gather from what you're saying that you're in the latter camp, that this is a big step forward and is a very creditable achievement for the president.
It's an extraordinary step forward. And what I would say to anybody who doesn't think it is, would you be willing to give up your own health insurance till we get a more perfect system? This is going to mean that somewhere around 30 million people have affordable health insurance for the first time. And it's going to save tens of thousands of lives a year, and it's going to change the trajectory of the healthcare system towards one that makes it more of a public good and less of just a commodity. So it's far from perfect, but nothing we've ever passed in this country starts at the ideal, and it is a major accomplishment. And the president is very much responsible for it, because at many times during the fight, his advisors told him to give up, and he refused to give up. So while we were not as happy that he didn't fight for, say, the public option as strongly, and he gave up some other provisions that we thought he could have fought for more, he still, when the going got tough with his back to the wall, he really did insist on working to get a system that had the promise of covering most people in the country. And for your listeners who want to learn more about the whole fight, that you can find information about my book and lots of pictures and video as well at the website, which is fightingforourhealth.com.
It was an extraordinary achievement, and I think the people. One of the problems is a lot of the people who campaign here are so alienated from the political system that they don't actually realize the type of maneuvers that are necessary to get legislation like this through two hostile houses on Capitol Hill and past the huge phalanx of lobbyists. So it's much easier not to join a counter lobby or to take part in the political process, but to write tirades on the internet.
Yeah, it's very easy to sort of, you know, wag your finger and say how this compromises that and how it's not perfect, you're not ideal. But we have in a loose sense, a democracy, and it is a political system where lots of voices and forces come in, and making change, particularly dramatic change, is incredibly difficult. And if you look at the history of change in this country, most efforts start with legislation, all do, which is far from what the ideals want. And oftentimes when they pass, people say, oh, it's just not good enough. But if you look back, the first civil rights legislation was weak, but it paved the way for stronger. The Social Security bill, when it first passed, left out so many people, wasn't indexed to inflation, and yet over time it got improved. So we've got a foundation to build on here, and we have to keep fighting, and meanwhile we have to be sure that millions of people get enrolled in health insurance.
Yeah. Well, the same applies to American legislation as applies to treaties, is that I think Bismarck said that a treaty was like a sausage. You don't want to watch it being made.
Right.
You have to eat it afterwards. Right. That's all we have time for now, Richard. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and it's been my pleasure to talk to Richard Kirst about his book Fighting for Our Health. Thanks very much, Richard.
It was great to talk with you, Ian.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.